A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host, book inspector and common thief. I have something I need to confess. In 2012, I stole a copy of McSorley's Wonderful Saloon by Joseph Mitchell in order to impress a boy. Listeners, I married him. Crime does pay, a bit. Firstly, my brand new book, The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shaped Me, is published by Headline and it's available online and from bookshops across the UK. This week's guest also has a brand new book out and a criminal connection. We're talking to Angela Clark, the prolific crime writer and broadcaster. On My Life is out now in Kindle. It's coming in paperback in July. And it has the unignorably thrilling tagline, framed, imprisoned, pregnant. It's the story of Jenna, whose idyllic life is shattered when she is jailed for a murder she didn't commit. She has to clear her name, save her baby and find the real killer. Angela is a Sunday Times bestseller whose social media murder series earned her an army of loyal superfans, including the crime legend Ian Rankin. Angela is a frequent TV and radio guest and host, talking about her writing, her work, teaching in prisons and her campaigning. She has the chronic condition Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and she does significant work around raising awareness for less visible disabilities. Angela is also a beloved old friend who was kind enough to introduce me to her agent, who is now my agent too. Hello, Diana, right at the beginning of my writing journey. Together we have celebrated, sobbed, nearly poisoned each other with port and almost murdered each other at the Eurostar check-in desk at the Gare du Nord. So we are in Angela's sitting room. I've had many happy evenings in this room, actually. We've had, it was where I first played Cards Against Humanity.
We nearly killed a slightly famous literary author by Death by Brownie.
Drink. Oh, Brownie.
Yeah, Death by Brownie. They then almost didn't make it home without being sick.
So, here I see a little grand. This is beautiful, actually. It's an amazing tower that looks like the books are freestanding, but they're not. Oh, there's a fabulous sort of collection of Roald Dahl. I suppose they're not all sins. Oh, we've got cruelty, madness, lust, deception.
Yeah, they're great short stories.
Topped by Nancy Mitford and bottomed by Patricia Highsmith and Raymond Chandler. So that's, and then Dylan Thomas cresting it all.
Yeah, I have very weird sort of categorisation. It's a bit random and it's usually based on visuals and it isn't even on kind of aesthetic visuals. It's on what I remember. Which makes it very odd, I suppose, which also means that nobody else can find a book.
So is this your kind of your vision of the book that's in your head?
Yeah. So I have a very strong visual on books. So if I think of a book, I think of the cover. Usually.
So you've got book synesthesia, kind of?
Yes, I have. Yeah, that is probably exactly what I
have. Can you talk us through this?
I'm not sure if I can translate it. So I like having them together. Obviously, I like having my kind of like little collections. I've got my Highsmith together, I've got my Roald Dahl's together, I've got my Nancy Mitford's together. But then there are also other versions of those books elsewhere in the house. So it's kind of a random system, which doesn't really make sense, does it? So I can't really describe it, but if we were upstairs, I could tell you and you said, oh, do you have any Patricia Highsmith? I'd be like, oh yeah, it's downstairs. And I know precisely where it is and stuff like that because of it makes sense in my head. It makes me very strange.
Do you think, because I think you've got a very strong visual memory and a kind of a visual sensibility, do you think that helps you as a writer? Can you see as you write?
Yeah, I can actually. That's true. I'm not sure whether it helps or not. People usually say that my work is, they always say cinematic. And I always find that really interesting because obviously I can see everything unfolding in my head when I'm writing. I can see my characters really clearly. I can see their world. I can see everything. But then I kind of assume, don't all writers do that? Isn't that kind of just what writers do?
And maybe it's in the detail.
Maybe.
I think. And how kind of spatially, you know, it's either the difference, I think, between a sketch with a pencil and a really...
Somebody has said, another author has said about my next book, which is a gritty thriller set in female prison, that they knew it was me because on page three it doesn't mention a Mac, it mentions a Burberry Mac, and they were like, you can take the writer out of fashion, but you can't take the fashion out of writer. And I was really annoyed because I was like, damn it, I wish I hadn't had that in there. It's not right.
That's something that I've heard writers talk about on... I really enjoyed recently, just to, you know, go listen to it. Please listen to this and then listen to this other great podcast. Izzy Sutty talking about Nina Stibbe on Rule of Three and saying the genius of her comedy is in her very specific detail. And I absolutely agree. But also I think, but don't all good writers do that? Like, if there is a way of making an object very specific, yeah, with a different word, then why wouldn't you use that instead of, you know, saying a dog or...
Yeah, I just read Twisted by Steve Kavanagh today, and he had a brilliant description of a guy where he said he looked like a snooker table with a beach ball on it that had been dressed and stood upright. And I was like, oh, that's blinding. I will have paraphrased that, so sorry to Steve for not getting it.
I've been to the gym with that guy.
I know that guy. As soon as he said it, I was like, oh my God, totally. So
that's probably a good time to talk about the fact that you are a listener to books as much as you are a reader. And I know that you read, you are an enthusiastic and diligent reader.
Yeah, that's definitely fair. So I do listen to a lot, and I started listening to books on Audible. I have a disability, in case people don't know. And sometimes, it sounds really stupid, but tilting my head and holding a book can be very difficult. And I was recommended that I stopped reading as a result of that. And I was like, no,
that's
not going to happen. And then somebody suggested spoken word. Mm. And I used to get the CDs out of the library, because if you buy them, they're like 35 quid.
They're expensive,
really expensive. And and I had to buy a CD player because I don't have a CD player. So I had to borrow a CD player from my mum and dad in order to listen to them.
So you have EDS?
Yeah, that's right.
Which I'm sure, you know, people familiar with your work, and, you know, you've written so brilliantly about it and spoken so brilliantly about it. But could you just describe sort of how it impacts you?
Sure. So it is a degenerative connective tissue disorder, which means that I have chronic pain and chronic fatigue, and I injure really easily. So it often affects my mobility, my ability to work and things like that. It's not going to kill me, which is good. Always a plus point.
I was going to say, hooray! Sounds really sarcastic and appropriate, but please, I'm delighted.
No. Yeah, I'm really pleased as well that it's not going to kill me. I mean, it might kill me if I, like, you know, dislocate something and then, like, fall in front of a bus. But, like, only in a really like, slapstick, stupid way. Exactly. Not in, like, the condition itself. But it's, so I have that, and it means that I have to make adjustments to my lifestyle, my life and what I do. And as I get older and bits wear out, those adjustments get a bit more necessary. And giving up reading books is just not possible. I had a really bad flare-up attack of my condition back in, I think it was 2013, just after my first book came out, and I dislocated my neck and I wasn't really able to walk for about 3 months. And I spent pretty much most of the year lying down, and it took me a year to get back to work and everything. And during that time, I was not allowed to watch television or read or look at my phone or anything that involved tilting my head at all or holding things up. I wasn't physically capable of doing it. So that's when I got heavily into listening to books. And I did the CDs. Dad came over with a very dodgy old CD player and CDs from the library, and then I started buying CDs. And
there's like really chunky cylindrical batteries.
It was like that.
All batteries.
And it was everything that you can get in, like, the the library is quite, it is what you would expect it to be, because the market is largely for spoken word stuff. It's for older people with sight difficulties or whatever. So it was a lot of Jane Austen, a lot of, I ordered in all the Hemingways and redid all the Hemingways, which is both of which I'd read already, but it was nice to listen to them. And then somebody introduced me to Audible and it blew my mind because I was like, wait, what? Hang on, I can get books, all the books, straight to my phone now. And also I can speed them up. Because that's the thing with spoken word. Everybody enunciates so clearly. And this is why when you listen to books like that, it sends you to sleep.
I suppose they're all actors, aren't they? Yes, and they want to do it in an actor-y fashion.
All of that, you know, kind of thing, which is great and fabulous. But that's not, you know, my brain works quicker than that and I need to absorb stuff quicker than that.
In the CD times, was there anything that you... a given way you thought, oh, I'm not, I wouldn't have found this normally, but okay, and ended up really enjoying?
That's a really good question. I did a lot of, there's a lot of kind of comedian memoirs. So a lot of kind of like old school comedian memoirs. And I did really enjoy those. They were really good. But then the writer brain in me always thinks, well, did they write these? Or did they have somebody else write them for them? I mean, probably if they were comedians, they probably wrote them themselves, I guess.
There's a lot of intimacy there, isn't it? It's sort of having someone tell you their life story.
Yeah, and they are really lovely, and I still do listen to a lot of memoirs, and they are always better if they're read by the person who's written them, and that is really fun. And actually, those kind of things I tend to listen to at night. That tends to be my kind of chill out, I'm getting ready for bed kind of stuff. I love a good biography as well, just before bed. There's a few on here, or
The Alan Partridge's Nomad.
And there's a Elizabeth Jane Howard's not the one that she wrote, but that's written about her. Oh God, where's it gone? I now can't see it. it's so here's me going like, oh yeah, I know where all the books are, and clearly I don't. So I must have moved it back upstairs.
You're a very successful crime writer, and there's masses and masses of fabulous scary crime here, lots of psychological thrillers. I see our mutual friend Claire McGowan, lots of her excellent books. You've got The Dead Ground, A Savage Hunger, and The Silent Dead. I think I remember, are we at Port Elliot, and she was fighting about the title of A Savage Hunger.
Yes.
It's like, should it be a rampant hunger? Yes. Should it be a greedy hunger?
Yeah, I think we had one of those conversations where you end up just basically shouting adjectives at each other and going, what about this? What about that? Yeah, and I've got Erin Kelly and Sharon Bolton here and William Shaw, a lot of kind of crime writers, active crime writers now, contemporary ones who I really, really admire. Like really fantastic writing, really kind of...
I think it's very interesting that you read crime so assiduously, I think that's the word I'm after, and in such a dedicated way, and you're writing it. Because I know lots of writers sort of avoid their genre or their area when they're writing because they don't want to kind of borrow anyone's voices. Which writers have you discovered that you've been the most inspired by?
Well, I'm inspired by all the old classics and I'm inspired by my contemporaries, but I don't tend to read contemporary crime when I'm actively writing my first draft. So I will read Golden Age crime, like I love Dorothy L. Sayers, and Georgette Heyer's crime books are fabulous. Her Honeyside and Hemingway detective stories are great. I've never actually read any of her sort of Regency...
The
love ones. I've not done those.
Ones.
Yeah, but her they're called romantic suspense, which is great because that's a genre that doesn't really exist in this country anymore. We don't publish romantic suspense because most crime nowadays in the UK books are quite gritty and realistic, and you can't really have gritty realistic and then a lovely romantic like relationship going on in the background.
Would you write it if you thought there was a thriving
audience? There's probably an audience. Well, I know there's an audience for it in other countries because apparently it exists as a genre, strong genre in Australia. And I think that America thinks that all British writers write like that still. They think that all crime writers, which is why it's often difficult for British crime writers, contemporary ones, to get published in the States because they think we're Christie. They think we're Agatha Christie. And if we don't, you know, that we all live in big houses and write jolly fun murders where there's no blood, no guts, no swearing and a big snog at the end. end, you know. And when you don't give them that, they're like, but this, what is this, you know, kind of thing. What is this thing about gangs and war and rape and drugs? What is this nonsense?
I should cancel my upcoming trip to Edinburgh.
I am not doing this. exactly. So I've got a massive soft spot for all of the kind of the Golden Age ones. I tend to prefer the female Golden Age writers. Like, I've got a fair few Raymond Chandlers and I've read a fair few of them, and I'm going to say something that is hugely controversial.
Oh, I like
it. I don't really like Raymond Chandler. So, like, obviously I recognise that he had an incredible talent and the way that he writes is brilliant, and I'm not the kind of writer that can mimic other writers, so I can't do that kind of, she was a dame with a duck, whatever, you know, I can't even, you know.
Weird fact about Angela, listeners. Angela does not hear accents.
No, I don't. No.
There is a story of yours I think about all the time. Do you want to tell it about your neighbours moving back to Ireland?
Oh, yeah, okay. So I had some neighbours that we would go for drinks for once a week. We were really friendly for like a couple of years. And then they were moving and had a leaving party. And we went to the pub and they were moving to Ireland. And I was like, so guys, why Ireland? And everybody kind of went silent and they gave me this really weird look. And Mr. Ange kind of leant over and went, honey, they're Irish. And I was like, oh, I had no idea. So I don't hear accents. I can never tell if anybody's posh. I've also got a friend who is a really good friend. I've been friends for like 5 years before she met Mr. Ange. And he was like, you never told me X was posh. And I was like, is she? And he's like, so posh, you know, kind of thing. So I've got nothing. So
coming in, there's a top hat and a monocle and they're adjusting them such good ears. So, yeah.
No. So, where are you from?
Where are you from? You know, kind of thing, what's your background?
So, I think it's interesting with all of that that you don't mimic as a writer either.
Yeah, that's true. I definitely unintentionally absorb stuff. So when I go through my edits, so because I won't read contemporary crime when I'm writing, I will go through my edits and I'll suddenly be like, why does this sound like Bertie Wooster in the middle of my draft, which is really inappropriate for a gritty, realistic, contemporary piece? And I'm like, oh, that's when I was rereading P.G. Woodhouse.
Some of your fans are into it, maybe not the commercial community.
Maybe.
So why is it, do you think, that you don't like Raymond Chandler?
Because because all the women are basically, they're just the angel or whore, and as soon as the whore character rocks up, who's usually blonde, you know that she's the killer. So not only is it like, you know, terrible stereotyping cliches, it's also really bloody obvious, and I find that really infuriating. Like a good Christie, a good Agatha Christie, and there is obviously variation in them, she wrote a lot of books, perfectly reasonable to have variation, but a good Agatha Christie will still get you, and you won't know who it is, you know. And I think especially when you're a crime writer, you learn to read the mechanisms, so it's quite normal for me to work out who it is, who's done it. So I love it when people pull the wool over my eyes. That's actually one of the reasons why
interesting.
Erin Kelly's one of my favourites, because I have never once been able to guess who it was with Erin's. She's absolutely brilliant at
that. So you'd rather not have the satisfaction of feeling like you'd unpick the clues. You want a bloody hell at the end.
Yeah, I want the twist. I want that satisfaction.
Can we write together a suspenseful romance in the style of Raymond Chandler?
That's
called How Do You Do? I Done a Sexy Murder.
Yes, absolutely. Let's do that. We should totally do that. Hopefully Raymond won't mind. I'm going to be haunted by Chandler's ghost. That would be great, wouldn't it? Actually, if you wanted to be haunted by a ghost, being haunted by Chandler's ghost would actually be really quite awesome.
Surely Agatha Christie.
I'd want to have Christie. I think I'd probably want to have maybe Virginia Woolf, but then I feel like that's an obvious one to go for. I just think, or Sylvia Plath, somebody...
Are you worried they'll be busy with the hauntings because they're so popular?
Because I think, yeah, they'll be booked up. Their dance card is full.
She's a jolly ghost, Ange, your third one, please, because I feel like Virginia Woolf and Sylvia Plath would be...
Oh, okay. Can I have Dorothy Alsayers then? It's the people that I want to have that I want to ask questions of. Well, of course, I don't know how the ghost relationship is going to work. They might not want to answer questions, you know, kind of thing. Like, one of the reasons I'd like Virginia and Sylvia is because I feel so much has been written about them and projected onto them that isn't necessarily anything to do with them. But they may not care about that. They might just want to knock things over and make weird noises at night and wake me up. So
I want to see whether they'd get on or whether they'd be a bit of like, oh, it's you. Hi.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. Oh, it's just all the gossip, basically.
Please write this.
Yeah, it'd be great, wouldn't it? Which is the hauntings of.
My favourite sort of slash fic.
Yeah, the hauntings of. But yeah, Dorothy would be awesome, Dorothy. I'll say it. Have you ever read any of her stuff?
I read a little bit as a teenager, and I don't really remember. I think my mum was like, you'll love this. And I was like, oh, will I, mum? And in a teenage way, but I should go back.
It's the Lord Peter Wimsey mysteries. And Lord Peter Wimsey, I think, is basically... I think she did something very clever. I think she took Jeeves and Worcester and set it to murder. But it made it a murder mystery, you know, kind of thing. That's effectively what she did, because you've got an aristocratic main character with a very supportive butler. And the aristocratic Lord Peter Wimsey is actually smart. He's not Bertie Worcester. But it just strikes me as that's what it is. And she, you know, she was a working jobbing writer. She needed to do it for money. And I've just always thought she was like, right, what you know, in the same way, if you were allowed to do, you know, the Wizarding World with a murder mystery, you'd make a fortune. You know, obviously you can't because of copyright, but yeah, that in that same kind of way. But
you
I think
can't
they really
copyright witches and wizards, can you?
No, but like, I mean, if you could take like Hogwarts, which I guess is why fan fiction is so popular, right? Because it's recreating worlds and putting new stories in them.
It's really thrilling, actually, isn't it? People saying, I love these characters so much and I want this to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because you want them to have lives, which they do, and you want to know what those continuous kind of lives are. But then I think that the books really take off when she introduces Harriet Vane in Strong Poison, who is basically her. So she's a mystery writer. I always like the female mystery writer characters best. So, who is it in Poirot? I've forgotten her name.
The other one.
Wanamaker. All I can think of is Zoe Wanamaker on the television.
I'm thinking of Jessica Fletcher, which is totally wrong. Nothing to do.
Who's also basically Marple. J.B. Fletcher is basically Marple. So, and she actually played Marple before anything else. Marples are my favourite. I reread them all recently in order. I had an operation, and first of all, I reread Mallory Towers because I was like, I need comfort. And I knew that I was feeling better when I started going, actually, I think it's quite cruel the way that they treat Gwendolyn. And when I think about it from a, you know, to begin with, I'm like, oh, this is so great. And I still feel so wonderful to be back amongst friends. And then I'm like, actually, with my adult, you know, like contemporary eye, I feel that the 2019 eye, I feel this is not correct.
I thought that because everybody, you know, there's this sort of secret. Not secret, but a group of women who are like, Amy is the best in Little Women. We've got a shit for Amy. And I think there's also, you know, emerging, because I'm like, if I'd been at Mallory Towers, I would have been Gwendolyn with Shades of Mary Lou.
Yeah. Oh, see, I like Mary Lou as well. And who's the one girl who comes, the one term, who is basically nouveau riche? And so she ends up nicking something and running off with one of the other girls, which is nowhere near as bad as what loads of the others do, who are instantly forgiven, but she's cast out because she's nouveau riche.
Is that Ellen?
Yeah, I think it is, actually.
Because Gwendolyn's desperate to make friends, and she makes friends with the wrong one. And is it Clarissa, who's a bit dowdy and sort of seems to be in shabby clothes, and then she's secretly a duchess or something,
absolutely.
Or a lady?
Absolutely.
That was it. And she gets led to the Honourable Clarissa.
That's right.
She's got a name like, it's not Clarissa Darling, because that's Clarissa Explains It All.
It is Clarissa something like that. Clarissa very posh. And but yeah, and I just felt sorry for Gwendolyn when I reread them as an adult. Like as a child, I was like, oh God, Gwendolyn's so terrible.
As a child, we were all like thinking about the music room. I was like, Daryl was right to hit Sally.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we all want to be Daryl, you know, kind of thing. But I felt really sorry for Gwendolyn rereading it. But then, like, I was like, okay, I'm not ready to come back to like the real world yet, so I started rereading the Marples in order. I love Poirot, and I've read most of them. I think I've read all of them, and then I reread them again, various ones periodically. But I as I get older, I love Marple more, much more. Marples or Poirot's?
Either Marples.
I think Marples are. There's I'm going to go with 12 to 14. Let's say somewhere around about that. That's a manageable number.
Because I thought it was going to be like 70.
No, there's. I think there's like 33, 36 Poirot's plus the short stories. And now plus you've got Sophie Hannah's ones as well that she's doing.
If you could choose a golden age crime author or any author who's long dead and isn't going to be very upset, all copyright issues aside, who would you pick up? Whose stories would you be telling?
I'd want to do Marple. I want to do Miss Marple. She's just such a great character. And in those books, Chrissy, just like the 450 from Paddington, has such brilliant female characters. So they've got Miss Marple herself, and the running joke through all of them is that everybody always like dismisses Miss Marple because she's an old lady. Mm. And I just think that it's almost like that seems more like prescient now, yes, than it perhaps it did, you know, then, kind of thing. And then you've also got her friend Elspeth McKillicuddy, who sees the murder committed on the train and knows that she will be dismissed because she's an older lady, even though she's quite forthright and quite direct, but knows that she won't be listened to by the police. And then they introduce Lucy Arlesworth, who is has a maths first from Cambridge, but decides, because it's after the war, makes a financial decision that it would be better to work as house staff, like, but be brilliant at it, because it's become so difficult to get staff to run houses that she basically comes in and like solves everybody's lives, you know, and enjoys doing it and does it really well, but is clearly really intelligent, so it, you know, in a super kind of problem solving way. So you've got these kind of three amazing female kind of characters in it, and I just think it's really, it just seems more and more relevant to today that we don't have like older female like dowdy ladies being really awesome characters, you know, kind of thing. And I love that. I don't know, when I read them all as well, because the Marples, they span from 1930s to 1970s, when she published them all through that period of time. So
some set in the 70s.
The last ones, the last one she wrote during the war, the last one that was published is Sleeping Murder, and she wrote that one in the war. It works perfectly, but it's odd in the sense that it doesn't have anything that ties it socially to the time, and she's so good at that. So like there's this wonderful bit when you watch them all unfold, because the world is changing around Miss Marple. I mean, she must have been like 150 by the end. It doesn't make any sense in that regard, but like it changes. And there's a wonderful bit where like in St Mary Mead there's a new housing development and they get a supermarket. And it's just great. And she's like, and you have to go around and pick the food off your shelves yourself and things like that. But she walks around this new housing estate where they've built all these new houses, and she listens at the window of people having conversations. Even though the houses look different and the people look different and things like that, people are still at heart the same. Mm. And they've still got the same kind of like compulsions and the same kind of moments of humanity. And I think that's really clever.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Angela soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week,
A book so good, it's worth 10 times its cover price. Please do not actually steal it. This week, it's Nikita Gill's Fierce Fairy Tales and Other Stories to Stir Your Soul, published by Trapeze, a stunning collection of vivid, moving stories and poems that will make you laugh, gasp, and maybe even cry. If you're a fan of Angela Carter, you'll adore this. That's Fierce Fairy Tales by Nikita Gill, out now. Now, back to Angela. Where did you get these? They're beautiful.
Oh, my tiny, tiny ones. Oh, they're John Donne, actually. These ones.
Oh, wow.
They're old copies of John Donne, collected John Donne poetry, he's probably my favourite author. My favourite poet, rather.
I don't know. How old do you think they are?
Well, they've got a signature in the front and a date of 1934. I bought them in Hay, actually. Yeah, I just love them. I just love them so much. They're so lovely. And they live down here because they live tucked in, so they don't get sunlight.
I love the beautiful illustrations on the end papers.
They're proper... they are lovely, aren't they? They are lovely. They are properly loved, though.
Was that when you were there for the festival?
I was... No, it was before that. It was before I was published. I've had these for years and years and years. And I've always loved Donne, and actually a quote was worked into it might not make it to the final edit, but the current book I'm writing, it's funny that a quote from him has ended up in it, you know.
Can kind you of say thing. Which line, or do you want to keep
it's, it's My America, My Newfound Land, and Come Lady Come, because it's quite a rude bit. So I discovered John Donne when I was a teenager.
I think you'll find it's Come Baby Come.
They're so rude. They're just like gloriously, gloriously rude. And I love that.
Did he come up at school, or did you just encounter him?
Did
you come to him?
Did I come to him? No, he came up at school. No, I read him first at school. We had to read The Flea, and then I read all of them after that. And that's how I came to Hemingway as well, because John Donne wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls. And then obviously that's the title that Hemingway used later. So that's how I found Hemingway.
I love that, and they're connected on the shelf, because I can see.
Oh my god, they are!
We have Donne under, and then Hemingway,
and then 1984, George Orwell on top. By the way, I think I've got three different versions of 1984, all in different colour coded around the house.
Weird dystopia. Have you?
I read a lot.
You read it three times more than the other books.
No, I don't. I have a big phobia of rats. That 1984 started, American Psycho finished, and I've never liked rats since then. Didn't have a problem before. This is you could basically call this my teenage shelf. I did like really stereotypical male teenage angst. I think was like quite to my shame. I didn't read many female authors until I went to university.
But I think there's something as well about all of these books are quite big books, or books that when you're, I think there's something that a lot of women do at a point when in their teens, when they're, you know, intelligent and ambitious, and they know there's something mentally that requires stimulation, they've really got to kind of push through for. And, you know, for a lot of us, especially I think me and you broadly grew up with where the internet was sort of just getting going, and you couldn't really consume culture as quickly as you could now in terms of things being recommended. It was very much like you go to the books in the canon, and that's what these are. And these are very, I think, all truly brilliant writers, but also writers that you'd sort of pick if you were
going to do a literature degree.
Or a pretentious teenager with
so
big
true.
Ideas who really wanted to signify something about herself.
It's so true. It's so true. A lot of what I read...
I say that with love. I think we're all pretentious teenagers.
No, absolutely. I was thinking about this earlier because I wondered if you were going to... Obviously, I've listened to the podcast. I love the podcast. And I wondered if you were going to ask me...
Keep that in,
me,
producer Dale.
I wondered if you were going to ask me, my first sexy book.
Yes!
Yeah, but I can't answer it because I don't know what it was.
Was it not John Donne?
Well, it probably was, but then I'd already had sex by the time I read John Donne. So, I think in a way that I don't know if it's because of when the internet, you know, like you say, the internet was just starting. So, you know, I had seen porn and that kind of skewed things. I read all of the Sweet Valley Highs that they had in my local library. I read every book that they had in my local library. It was only a little library. It was one of those porter cabins, and I'd read all of that, and I remember reading all of the Sweet Valley Highs. I remember reading all of the Judy Blume, but I have no recollection of reading Forever, or if I did, I have no recollection of like the sexy bits. I have no recollection of reading Riders the first time, or Lace, or any of the ones that are kind of famous for being handed round.
The other canon.
Yeah, the other canon. I don't know if I just did and I wasn't emotionally mature enough to get it, so I was just like, oh, not interested in this, where's the plot going? Or I didn't care. The only, like, sexy book I remember read like, actually about sex was... like the Osborne's like guide to being an adolescent.
The strangely beige humans and the various sort of...
that my mum bought me and told me that, you know, which was her way of telling me about periods, that I should read to page 15 and no further. Obviously, then I read everything further immediately and learnt all about sex and HIV and because there was a whole section on AIDS and all of this kind of stuff. So I remember reading that.
So just, you know, I don't know how much if you're... your life and times you wish to reveal, but just to anchor that in a time period, I wonder, was it frightening? Was it sort of early 90s, mid 90s?
So it would have been early 90s, I guess. So I was I was born in 1980, so I would have been 11 in 91.
Because I can just imagine being just terrified to learn about AIDS from an Osborne book.
I don't remember it being frightening. So this is the thing. I just remember it being like, oh, interesting. And then that's it, moving on. I think I was really odd. I think by the time I got like heavily interested, like hormonally in sex, I just started having sex. And so books formed quite a really heavily link to that. Like, so I remember with my first boyfriend, let's go with 95. we would... as part of our courtship, we read out loud to each other Trainspotting by Irvine Welsh, and we read out loud to each other Bret Easton Ellis, American Psycho. And it's like you said, it's that kind of, we were going for those kind of like raw, visceral teenage, making a real impact. This is the coolest book that you've got to read.
Book.
All men. And I never saw that.
Were they coming from him or from you, or did you sort of decide
remember.
On them?
I don't remember, but I honestly don't remember, but we were like, whatever was the kind of the most violent and the most, like, forbidden in that sense, we wanted to get our hands on and read, and so that's what we read, and we thought they were brilliant. And from that we got to Orwell and other places.
Being so surprised by Trainspotting, because I think that film came out, I would have been, I think, 9 or 10, and I remember all the posters, and it was such a sort of an iconic, everywhere you went, it was like that black and sort of whitey grey with the neon. It was like, oh, it's a not bad film about drugs and all the things that happen. And obviously, you know how it is when kids are like, oh yeah, I've seen it. And like, it's just, you know, inventing scenes of sort of decapitation and terrible.
We definitely did that with the reading side of it. So it was definitely cool for us to have read it, but it's a brilliant book.
Well, that was it. It's so funny. Yeah. It's so sad. It's so poignant. I just thought it was going to be like, fucking drugs, man, for 300 pages.
No,
and
it's so
that wasn't a Scottish accent. I don't know what accent that was.
Well, I wouldn't have been able to tell anyway. So one of the greatest moments I had happened to me recently was I got to meet Irvine Welsh for the first time, and we ended up hanging out for a bit, which was fucking amazing. And I couldn't...
How were you?
I was at Bloody Scotland, the festival in Bloody Scotland, and we ended up going for drinks and having dinner, and it was amazing. And during it, I went to the bathroom and texted my boyfriend from when I was 15, who I haven't spoken to. I could see the last time I spoke to him was 9 years ago. And I was like, you will never believe where I am right now, because I knew that nobody else would understand quite how monumental that was to be 15, like lying in our pants, like reading it out loud to each other. Because
did
also,
you tell him?
Yeah. I told everyone as well. And he was like, okay, weird.
Because it's kind of like, I've had sex to your book. Like, thanks.
I'm sure he's heard a lot worse. You've read the book, you've seen the movie. I'm sure he's heard a lot worse. I don't think he even batted an eyelid over that. But it was, you know, it was such a core part of my kind of my coming of age, I suppose. So that's it's not a sexy book, because obviously it's not, but that's my sexy book. Like, that's what it's linked to, that kind of like electricity, the kind of like being, you know, like discovering this incredible, like, forbidden thing and enjoying it with somebody else. And the reason why we started reading them out loud to each other is because of the dialect. We couldn't read it any other way. And we were like, we couldn't work out what it was saying until we read it out loud. And we're like, okay, now we know what it is, because it's obviously so heavily written.
So good on that. So that must be the closest you've come to hearing an accent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can tell, obviously, when people like use words that are linked to Scotland, obviously, if somebody says we. But then I thought that Steve Kavanagh was Scottish because he says we. And he's like, no, I'm Northern Irish. And she's like, okay, my bad. I'm sorry. So you could basically mess with me just by using random kind of like dialectical words.
So if I kind of keep saying howdy and y'all.
Yeah, yeah, I'll just be like, oh, I didn't know that Daisy is from the Deep South. Though you're called Daisy, so that's obviously, you know, obviously should have got that.
That's the petticoats. Absolutely. They're another big indication.
Big clue. Yeah, so all of my like male teenage angst kind of kind of like visceral book. But they're all great books. I feel slightly like I wish I could go back and I wonder what had happened if I'd read more seminal female writers at that kind of age.
But then I think you're doing a pretty great job of that now. And also perhaps now you'd be disinclined to read the big guys.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm quite derogatory about Hemingway, and you know, you always meet the guy in the creative writing class who thinks he's Hemingway. Like, it's such a cliche. But the reality is, I do love Hemingway, and I love his clips.
Everyone's got Tesco brand whiskey in their pocket.
Writer's tears. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, they always think they're Hemingway. They're not, because they always use too many words and their sentences aren't short and sharp enough. But I still love Hemingway. He's still probably one of my all-time faves.
Do you love him for his prose alone, or do you think there is a bit of you that loves that, the cult of the writer that
I do love the cult of the writer, but of course he was a complete twat.
Yeah.
And I loved Mrs. Hemingway by Naomi, no, not Naomi Wolf, wrong Wolf. Maybe it is Naomi Wolf.
That sounds familiar.
This is why I'm very visual, because I'm terrible at names, titles, all of those things, which makes me sound like
a really stupid writer. If you went to Google Mrs. Hemingway and Wolf, yeah, you would find it. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, they, Mrs. Hemingway is an amazing book told from the four different perspectives of Hemingway's four wives, and it is fascinating and brilliant. And because I read that, I read like Martha
Gellhorn.
Thank you. I read her book Beautiful Exile, which is lovely, and I don't think it's published anymore in this country. I had to get it shipped in. Like, her life is amazing, and I love like the Elizabeth Jane Howard one. I want to say that's called a beautiful something or an ordinary something. I don't know. I'll find it in a minute.
You don't have to answer this, but I'm curious, because I know that if you want something book related, you will track it down.
Yeah.
What's the most money you've ever spent on one book?
Ooh, good question. Oh, I don't know. I have to think about that. I've definitely spent over £100, like more than once on a book, more than once.
Do you know which ones?
I spent £100 on more than £100 on the Manolo Blahnik book, which is signed. I'm Manolo Blahnik. That's my past coming out because I really wanted it. massive fan of his work, and it's signed by him and the photographer, which is really cool. It's at the bottom of the big pile. You probably can slide it out, but might be like a toppling situation going on.
I'd be very nervous about knowing. I mean, I imagine that's probably a book that's worth a lot now. I don't think you would want to do anything with it. But
there is a book that I've had my eye on that I haven't bought, but you can't get in this country, which is an accompaniment to Dorothy L. Sayers, which has all of the quotes that she uses, because she's so literary. There's so much Latin and stuff like that in it.
Dorothy L. Sayers specific dictionary of quotations.
Yes, for everything that she used, but it's only ever been produced in America. And I looked that up several times, and the last time I looked, it was 256. And I haven't bought it, but I do periodically go back and see.
So it's $256?
No, pounds, because it was over here, and I think that somebody had shipped it. I don't even know if it's published anymore in the States. I think it's out of publication completely, but they never published it over here. And I would love that. I did spend quite a lot.
American listeners, you know what to do.
Yeah, yeah. If you see one of those, please send me one.
She'll PayPal you.
I will PayPal you. Yeah, absolutely. I did spend quite a lot of money on a book about poisons that is no longer. It's no longer in publication. Which obviously I largely...
It was a mistake to drink that herbal tea.
Peppermint and licorice, it was a lie. But I don't, it's stupid because like you can't really, I mean, you can use poisons. I think that Mark Billingham is going to use poison in one of his next ones, but from something that he said. But it's such a Christie thing that like you couldn't really get away with using loads of poisons. But it is really fascinating to read all about all the different types and stuff like that. And it is then fun when you go back through like the Marples and you're just like, oh yeah. Strychnine, I know that. Also, poison seems to be like a hell of a lot more, like it's much harder to get hold of now. Mm. Except it probably isn't because you just buy it on the internet, on the dark net.
I don't know. Maybe on the dark web. I was going to say, I wouldn't know how to get onto the dark web, which sounds like I'm protesting too much. But I tried to buy castor oil from a chemist the other day to make my eyelashes grow. And they said, we can't sell that to you because we're worried that you'll make a bomb out of it.
Wow. Did you try to buy a lot of it or they just didn't like the look of you?
I think all of the above. And I was buying matches and petrol. No, they just, I think there's, you just can't sell it domestically anymore.
Wow. Really? I had no idea. Wow. Okay. That's really fascinating. That is really fascinating.
If ever your past and present lives collide a little, some sort of beauty matter.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. I mean, I'm pretty sure that...
Oh, well, Villanelle.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm pretty sure that I haven't read the books. I have to be honest, I haven't read the Villanelle books. But, you know, watch the telly. Obviously, the telly was very good.
The thing is, in the books, I know I'm not the first person to say this. I'm the 800 millionth person to say this, but oh my God, the frogs.
Yeah, gorgeous. Really gorgeous. And it really heightens it.
Unless the books are pop-up.
Unless, a real detailed description of her clothes. I don't think there is, actually. I've never heard anybody mention the clothes in the books. Having said that, it's not the kind of thing that everybody would notice, I suppose.
Couldn't not notice that pink dress. Shall we go upstairs?
Yeah. My pals and I, my fellow crime writers, we're definitely all flagged for our search history. definitely all on some watch list. Listen, let me turn the radio on.
We're in the study of... Sunday Times best-selling crime writer Andrea Clark, and I've got to tell you, smells amazing in here. Is that diptyque? What is that?
It is. It's just Neil's Yard oils. I can't do caffeine. I don't do tea or coffee, so I've tricked my brain that I'm awake by putting certain oils. Not that one because that's lavender.
That's lavender.
That will send me to sleep. They're over here.
They diffuse it out of that wooden.
Yeah, they diffuse out the wooden thing, and it's how I keep myself awake. So I have loads of focus and energy ones. See, I've reduced my collection. I got rid of about 300 books recently because I Marie Kondo'd before it was on Netflix. I hasten to add.
There's still lots here. I see a friend of the podcast and friend of ours, Lauren Bravo. Spice Girls do?
Yes, these are my, so I have like a vague system going on. So these are ones that are sent to me. I get about 10 a week and then I try to read them in order that they kind of come out. When I've read them, they then go on this shelf here before being redistributed around the system kind of way. It's more crime, isn't it? It's more crime. It's a lot of crime.
You've got an enormous, beautiful-looking edition of Agatha Christie's Complete Secret Notebooks.
You bought that for me. You genuinely bought that for me.
Oh, God.
A few Christmases ago. And I love it.
Oh.
It's great.
I do remember that because I remember being quite worried that you might have it.
It goes really well with her autobiography, which I just reread again, which is possibly the best book she ever wrote.
And
it's really fascinating. She very carefully like dodges the dodgy 2 weeks where she vanished, and she does refer to it a little bit and says that she had basically a mental health episode, and that's what and she should have seen warning signs beforehand. So she talks about the warning signs beforehand and then afterwards, but never divulges what she was actually doing when she vanished for those 2 weeks. Though personally, I like to think she was basically trying to frame her the woman who'd stolen her husband for killing her. I think that's what she was trying to do. And I don't know whether or not she was doing that in a she was okay way or she was doing that in she was not very well way. But either way, it's awesome
I really hope that was the case. I mean, how do you think she writes about mental health in her autobiography. Do you think, because it sounds like she's got a kind of fairly modern or contemporary perspective on it? Yeah,
yes and no, because I mean, she starts out a lot. She's very dismissive of what my gran would have called namby-pamby attitudes towards children. And she's very much like, I was just allowed to play outside and I'm fine, you know, kind of thing. And everybody, no children need nothing else and no kind of, you know, mollycoddling or anything like that. So she's quite like of her time in that regard. And obviously she was of a certain social class and that kind of comes through. But actually on certain things like mental health, I mean, I think because she was clearly interested in human psychology and psychiatry and definitely was abreast of kind of developments of that and what was happening, that she's actually fairly good on that. So she talks about the pressure that led up to the breakdown between her marriage and how her mother died at the same time, and she was on her own trying to clear out the house, the family home, separated from her husband, like physically, but not actually. She didn't know that their relationship was over, and he was off with what was going to become his new wife, and all this kind of stuff. And she was like, you know, I there was moments where I remember sort of coming to in places. And thinking, how am I here and what's happened? And that was a warning sign.
So
I pushed too hard.
Depersonalization.
Yeah. And I think she talks about it in terms of kind of it becoming too much for her mind, to her mind shutting down, and which I think is probably very true, isn't it? I think she was very true judge of character and a very true judge of kind of human emotion, which I guess is why the stories work so well. But I think, therefore, she has a very astute view of her own mental health and what was going on in that situation.
I suppose that's it, that she's so used to having to know a character's motivation, she can look back at that time and think, well, that's why. That's fascinating. And I suppose because she's such a... these books are so powerful and so widely read, to think of her as someone who, you know, has lived this life and had these vulnerabilities.
There's definitely PR spin in it as well. I mean, she's telling her story, and she obviously took the conscious decision to do it before she died and before somebody else could do it, you know, kind of thing. And I think she's definitely like, right, I'm going to write down what happened, you know, my relationship with my children, my relationship with my husband, and get it down fixed in time in that sense. And it's a great read. It's really good.
So you said you comma read. What is it about these books that have made the cut?
Well, I tend to keep ones that either I love and that I reread, ones that are kind of research. So I've got like a lot of research ones over there. I have all of my poison books and various kind of stuff on forensics and stuff like that.
Oh, you have to do big, massive murders, yeah. But not for real purposes, honest.
Absolutely, absolutely.
By John Murder.
By I Done It.
I see you've got Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman.
Yes.
Which means I can ask you about this and about your screenwriting life.
My screenwriting life is less developed than my book writing life, but it's something that I'm moving into. I think story works across all platforms, doesn't it? That's the kind of unifying factor.
And especially, you know, you're, as we've said before, a cinematic writer.
That's true. But then I'm learning as well when I write scripts that though I think of myself as a cinematic writer, it's still a difference between writing for novels, which is very internal, and making sure that you're getting the visuals across in a script. But it's a really fun thing to do. And like the bookworm that I am, I read a lot to try and get like a handle on things. So I also read a fair amount of scripts as well. So there's various scripts lying around and various book forms of scripts, which are always fun. And I have a load of plays, actually. I have like a slightly embarrassing number of plays. I couldn't get rid of those things because I love them. And I think it's the kind of thing that you do reread. I keep everything that's signed, everything that I'm quoted on, because I'm vain.
I think that's permitted.
Is that allowed? I don't know. I mean, I kind of tricked myself because I was kind of like, I could get rid of them and then I could just buy more. I think also as well, because I can't hold books so much anymore, it's become less important for me to keep collecting them. This is a total lie, basically what happens is I just listen to them, and if I love them then I buy the book anyway because I want it to refer to it and I want it visually to remember.
Because I get the sense that you feel very strongly about them aesthetically and as loved yeah. objects and sort of decorative objects that tell a story about you as well as the story that they're telling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, books are very aesthetically pleasing, aren't they? And they smell nice and they feel nice and they stay, you know, they're more than their singular parts, I'm not sure. But then we're standing facing...
You talking about books sounds a little bit like, and I mean this with such love and affection because it thrills me, a bit like Bridget Jones talking to Colin Firth about Mr. Darcy. Just really nice.
Just really nice, really lovely. Yeah, but they're my friends. Like, they've always been my friends. And it's very difficult to kind of... And now, literally, a lot of them... Are your friends. Yeah. I think authors I find to be so friendly and so welcoming. Crime in particular is such a wonderful kind of supportive kind of industry to be in. And maybe some of the other genres are less supportive, I don't know. But mostly everybody I come across is just really nice. And because it's like we all speak the same language.
Favourite thing is, I think you had a book launch where there was a massive minimum bar spend, and I think the crime writers get through it in about
8 minutes. I think we did it in 8 minutes. I was like, yeah, we're going to have to stay open till midnight, and we'd spent the entire budget within 8 minutes, and it was like, oh, okay, yay, go. Maybe that's why
the crime writers,
we're just all drunk.
You can have a Capri Sun.
You're all done. I got these ones out because I thought these were all kind of firm favourites. But we have discussed Christy.
So we have a magical pile. We've talked about Christy, Georgette Hare, Christmas Party, that is. That's a title I am desperate to read. And it's January now, time for recording.
Yeah, you've got to read. So this was originally called Envious Casca, which is probably not how it's pronounced. It's one of those books where you like a lot of writers, I learnt words by reading, so I don't pronounce them off on the right way, but I think it's a quote from Julius Caesar, from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Anyway, Envious Casca, but they re-released it as A Christmas Party, and this is one of those romantic suspenses, and it's great. It's really, really, really joyful, and I would highly recommend it. You've got to read it. It's really good. Really good.
It's the season to find who'd done it.
It's great.
That's one of those lines, isn't it? Like, we'll think of something better later, but it works.
But it really works. Okay. Oh, look, see, and recommended by India Knight and Dorothy L. Sayers. I mean, you can't get higher praise than that, can you? So
it's a awesome. Delight to me.
Big Magic.
Big Magic is the...
Big Magic is the book that I probably...
About Elizabeth Gilbert.
Yeah, Elizabeth Gilbert. So I actually haven't read any of Elizabeth Gilbert's other work. So I haven't read Eat, Pray, Love, which is obviously the big one. But I reread Big Magic, which is Creative Living Beyond Fear. Multiple times. I would say at least 4 times a year. And it is probably my most recommended and most gifted book to other people, largely because a lot of other people I know are writers. And what we do can be really difficult because you're putting bits of yourself, like your soul, onto pages, and then you're publishing it in a world where everybody has an opinion. And that can be very hard. It's also in a world where you can see everybody else's successes really easily, and it's quite difficult not to do kind of comparinitis and stuff like that. And I think that she...
I'm nodding so hard that my head might fall
off. I think that she really tackles all of that really brilliantly and reminds you why doing creative things is so important to everybody, regardless of what happens to those creative things, whether they're a huge success or nobody else ever gets to see them, that's not the point. Mm. She just writes beautifully and so cleverly, and actually takes on the kind of... She starts by kind of deconstructing the Hemingways, and like you were saying, you know, if it was that they'd all be sat around in a drunk and being bitter and stuff like that, and she deconstructs that, and she's like, why do you want to be like, because you want to be an artist, why do you want to be destructive? It's not necessary, you know. You don't have to be a great writer, you don't have to be like self-destructive, and it's just so many times everybody, like, if they're feeling sad or they're struggling or you know, and in particular about their work, I always find myself being like, read this, it will make you feel better.
Huge thanks to Angela. On My Life is published by Mulholland Books and out now. It's compulsive, pacey and chilling. Once you start reading, you won't stop. Follow Angela on social media at The Angela Clark. She's also a compulsive reader, and it's worth it for the book recommendations alone. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for joining me for our frolic in the stacks. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time and I leave you with the words of Fernando Pessoa. Literature is the most agreeable way of ignoring life.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.